Welcome to Ancient Future Faith with Dr. Chris Alford, pastor of Epiclesis, an ancient future faith community in Sacramento. Just what is ancient future Christian faith? Join Chris each week as he talks with special guests about a refreshing renewal in evangelical worship and spirituality that's helping many believers get in touch with their ancient Christian heritage. Now, with another look at how the road to the evangelical future runs through the ancient past, here's Dr. Chris Alford.
Well, hi, folks, and welcome back to another edition of Ancient Future Faith. A blessed Holy Week to you, and a very, very happy Eastertide season. That's what we want to talk about today. And on the phone with me for this edition of Ancient Future Faith is one of my dearest friends in the whole wide world and somebody I love to talk about these things with and even go traveling with, which I hope we can talk about a little bit, Carl, is my dear friend, Dr. Carl Peters. Hi, Carl. Welcome.
Hi, Dr. Chris. So good to be with you today.
I just love having you on the program. You're so much fun to talk to. And as I hinted just a minute ago, you're fun to travel with as well. So I hope we could talk about it. We've done several trips, haven't we? But the one to the Holy Land was the best, I think. And I hope we get to talk about that. Carl, as people are hearing this episode of Ancient Future Faith, it's Holy Week, the highest point of the entire Christian year, something that I think evangelicals and believers of all stripes acknowledge and highlight, at least in some sort of way. And it's really always been an important one for us, I guess, at least to start with, because of our history as music ministers, right? One of the most busy times of the year.
Yeah, this was the season of the year people knew we would be a little grumpy because we'd be working on musicals or getting the choir just right for whatever presentation we were going to make during Holy Week.
Yeah, and then we got some edumacation about church history and worship theology and, my goodness, just a whole new world of theology and history and tradition opened up to us, didn't it?
It seems like the pageants that we geared up for Good Friday or for Easter Sunday, there's really nothing new about these celebrations. They date all the way back to the very first few centuries of the Christian church, and people would make pilgrimages to the Holy Land to follow the very footsteps of Jesus, particularly during Holy Week. And Chris, I know that you've done some studies on this from a dear lady named Egeria, who is worth reading.
I hope that we will have the time to touch on her and the remarkable diary that she wrote. This, friends, is in the late 4th century that she's writing. But I do want us to say just for half a minute, and this is speculation, I guess, on my part a little bit, but I think you'll agree, Carl, one of the things surely that unites all of us at a time like this, Holy Week, is that I mentioned earlier it's the high point of the Christian year, but there's something about Holy Week and the traditions that really connect us. I like to say we hold hands with our brothers and sisters before us. It makes you feel rooted in the tradition, doesn't it, Carl?
It really does. We're connected to such a great, great tradition. Christians who've come before us, who've walked this same path, it's still warm from their presence. And as we celebrate these transcendent, epic days in our faith, we can know that our brothers and sisters have been there before us, and it adds a depth to the celebration that you don't find in much of the year. So, indeed.
At our church at Epiclesis here in Sacramento, and by the way, folks can zip over to the Epiclesis website, epiclesis.org, to learn a little more. We have been observing the season of Lent up through and including Holy Week. Technically, Lent continues through Holy Week all the way to Resurrection Sunday. But Holy Week begins on Palm Sunday. Now, as people are listening to this interview, Carl, it will have been the previous Sunday. But Holy Week begins with Palm Sunday. And I suppose that's one that's familiar with a lot of folks, right? It's the Sunday that Jesus rides triumphantly into Jerusalem. You and I were talking earlier about some of the interesting aspects and details about that triumphal entry. You want to talk just a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, we all are familiar with the colt and Jesus sending his disciples to secure a colt for his entry into Jerusalem. And I've always found it fascinating that the people who owned this little animal were very quick to turn it over to people they probably didn't know at all. It seems unlikely, except for the fact that this is a part of God's plan, and those folks were unwittingly or knowingly a part of his plan. So it's just neat to see how God has already worked these things out. And one of the things we mentioned, Chris, is an insight that I think is quite fascinating, and that is Jesus is riding a colt that has never been ridden before, particularly in Mark's gospel. This is year B, so we're looking at Mark. Mark's gospel says that this is a virgin colt, if you will, never been ridden before.
Untamed, as it were,
Untamed, unbroken. It would not be an easy ride for Jesus.
Right.
So it's interesting to note that back in the Garden of Eden, Adam had a very good relationship with the animals. He was brought the animals, and then he was to name them. And there was just a peace between animals and human beings. But because of sin, what we find later when Noah, sort of presented as a new Adam, is given dominion over the animals, things are a little different because there's enmity between Noah and the animals. Right. There is a separation. There's no longer the peace. Mm. Now Jesus comes along, and in a very subtle way, it may be said that Jesus is returning to that paradise of the garden as he is at peace with this colt.
Yeah.
It's a very subtle thing, but I think a significant one.
I do too. It's as if the curse is already beginning to be reversed, and it reminds me, as I know it does you, of that passage where Jesus is tempted in the desert, and it says there that the wild animals attended to him. So it's another, I think, foreshadowing of the reversal of the curse and the redemption of the whole created order. Folks may not have thought about that. Palm Sunday is, again, one of those parts of Holy Week that I guess a lot of people are familiar with, but there are some other highlights of the week that maybe evangelicals in particular don't know about. What in the world happens on Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday? Maundy, Thursday, we know a little bit about, but what about Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday? I'm going to ask my guest, Dr. Carl Peters, to talk about that here in just a second. But first, before he does that, let me remind you that you're listening to a podcast and radio program called Ancient Future Faith. It's brought to you by the folks at Epiclesis. You can learn more about Epiclesis at epiclesis.org. Zip over to the website, learn more about us there. You can also subscribe to our podcasts at iTunes or get all of the archived recordings of these programs at epiclesis.org. My guest today, as I said, is my good buddy, Dr. Carl Peters, and we're talking about Holy Week. Carl, it seems like at least the way we observe Holy Week, it's more like a holy 3 days or something, right? But we forget that there were important things that happened on Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday of Holy Week, yes?
Yes, indeed. And I don't know that we have an exact layout of what happened, but I think most theologians would place these events in a certain order. And on Monday, Jesus curses the fig tree. And that's found in Mark 11, verses 12 through 14, if you'd like to look that up. It says, on the following day, they came from Bethany. He was hungry, and seeing in the distance a fig tree and leaf, he went to see if he could find anything on it. When he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for it was not the season for figs. How ironic that he's looking for figs and it's not the season for figs. There must be a deeper theological statement being made.
Yes, indeed.
So he said to it in verse 14, may no one ever eat fruit from you again. And his disciples heard it. It's an odd kind of expression here to curse a fig tree. But Chris, if I may, one of the beliefs is that the fruit that the serpent used to entice Eve and then Adam into sin, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, was believed to have been a fig tree.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you understand that, it begins to make a little bit of sense, because if it's a fig tree, then it provided the fruit for their sin, and the fig tree then represents sin and death. Now it becomes clear Jesus is rebuking and cursing sin and death, which is exactly what he would defeat at the cross.
Yeah.
There's an old extra-biblical account, the life of Adam and Eve, also known as the Apocalypse of Moses. And if I may, I'd like to just read this little quote.
Yes.
Eve said, at that very hour, my eyes were opened, and forthwith I knew that I was naked of the righteousness with which I had been clothed, and I wept. And I began to seek in my nakedness, in my part, for leaves to hide my shame. But I did not find any, except leaves of the fig tree only. And I took leaves from it and made for myself a loincloth. They were from the same plants of which I ate. So this is the longstanding tradition and thought that it was the fig that was the fruit of their sin. And now it makes all the sense in the world that Jesus would curse the fig tree.
What about other events in Holy Week, Carl, that we might not think about?
Well, we find on Tuesday that Jesus entered the temple and he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold pigeons, and he would not allow anyone to carry anything through the temple. He was teaching them and saying to them, "Is it not written, 'My house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations'?" I think in our deliberations on this, Chris, we've discussed this several times, how Jesus was not so much upset for the fact that these folks were providing a needed service for the pilgrims who came without the ability to bring their own sacrifice. They would purchase sacrifices there, or they would change out Roman currency or other currency with currency they could use in the temple to pay the temple tax. So the issue here is not so much buying and selling. It is the fact that they are in the outer court. They're in the court of the Gentiles. And they are pushing out the place that the only place the Gentiles could come to worship was this outer court. So what does Jesus say? "Is it not written, 'My house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations'?"
For all nations.
Here we see the inclusion of the Gentiles and the desire of Jesus to return worship to the people and to allow it not to be bastardized by the introduction of animals and sales being finalized and so forth.
Well, and the very physical picture, right, of actually pushing out Gentiles who have come there, when Jesus' whole mission is to complete that which the children of Israel were supposed to be, and that is a light to the entire world. We're talking Holy Week here with Dr. Carl Peters. He's the pastor of Anchor Baptist Church in Lexington, Kentucky. And we had the great pleasure, Carl, of doing like thousands of people before us and making a pilgrimage trek to Jerusalem some years ago. What a stunning time that was. And practically the whole time, my mind was going toward this amazing woman named Egeria who traveled there in the late 4th century. You too, I guess?
I think so. She kept a diary of her activities and such beautiful depictions of their daily walking out the path that Jesus tread in Holy Week as he moved eventually to Thursday night and the Last Supper, then his Garden of Gethsemane arrest, the trials, and then his crucifixion. She does a marvelous job of sharing how those beautiful Kairos moments became the very points of her journey as she was a pilgrim there in the Holy City during Holy Week.
So get this, folks, a woman probably from Spain and very probably a nun, though we're not sure, goes on this grand tour that includes the Holy Land, and she is there in the Holy Land and particularly Jerusalem during Holy Week. This is long about the year 384. So it's the same century that we get the legalization of Christianity. It's the same century, in fact, just a few years after the completion of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which you can go to this very day in Jerusalem, which Carl and I did. And during Holy Week in the Holy Land, there were all kinds of services that would absolutely wear out any normal person. I'll give you just a brief overview, then we want to talk about Maundy Thursday and Friday and Saturday. But Saturday before Palm Sunday, there was a worship service in Bethany. On Palm Sunday, there would be services around various churches in Jerusalem, and then a procession to the Mount of Olives. On Monday, a huge celebration worship service at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. On Tuesday, the same thing, and then also back to the Mount of Olives. On Wednesday, back to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. On Monday, Thursday, there at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and then back to the Mount of Olives, and then to Gethsemane, and then back to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Good Friday, Vigil of Easter. Easter Sunday, of course, a great celebration. And then there is a whole series of 8 days of celebration called the Easter Octave at various churches in Jerusalem following Easter. Carl, just reading the list makes me tired. And you read this marvelous account, this firsthand diary account of Egeria, and you just marvel at the, dedication and love of these pilgrims who would go to Jerusalem during Holy Week. It's stunning.
It really is. And they didn't go back to a 4-star hotel at the end of the day.
No.
They were guests in the city, and I'm sure it was a very grueling week, but one that is spiritually meaningful beyond description, even though she does a wonderful job attempting just that.
Now, folks are probably familiar with the name Maundy Thursday. That's the Thursday of Holy Week. At least at our church, we mark that evening with a service of shadows, a tenebrae service. Maundy, by the way, gets its name from the Latin phrase mandatum novum, which translated is a new commandment. And of course, people will remember that it is on that Thursday night in the upper room where Jesus says, "A new commandment I give to you." That's the night that Jesus gathers with his disciples in the upper room, already prepared for them, and in effect rewrites the liturgy of the Passover and says, "Everything you knew before points to me. All of it is found in me. And now I'm making the ultimate covenant with you in my own body and blood." What a remarkable night of Holy Week. Yes, Carl?
Oh, absolutely. This Thursday night supper, reinterpreted to focus on Jesus, makes Jesus the Passover lamb. It places him at the heart of the feast, reinterpreting it for a new Exodus led by a new Moses, with Jesus himself as the new Moses, but also Jesus as the new Passover lamb, the lamb who would be sacrificed. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing, but it also is a vital thing in order for the sacrifice on Friday to truly be a sacrifice. The meal on Thursday had to be reinterpreted according to Jesus and his purposes. And what I mean by that, Chris, there were four things that had to happen for Jesus' death on the cross to be a sacrifice. And these things are not readily apparent. For there to be a sacrifice, rather than just a Roman execution, because anyone who would have walked by on Good Friday would have said Jesus is just another sad Jewish man being executed by our enemies, the Romans. But what was happening, as we know, is the once and for all sacrifice that puts an end to all animal sacrifices. We know this is the ultimate sacrifice, and Jesus, the Lamb of God, took upon himself the sin of the world. So what makes this a sacrifice? There had to be four things in place for a sacrifice to be legitimate. One, it had to be at the temple. Two, it had to be presided over by a priest. Three, the sacrificial victim had to be appropriate. And four, it had to be part of a liturgy. What is so incredible, as you survey those four items, you realize Jesus said, "Tear this temple down and I will rebuild it in 3 days." And he wasn't talking about the building, he was talking about his body. Indeed. So if Jesus is the temple, then indeed the crucifixion, which was actually outside the gates of Jerusalem, if Jesus is the temple, it was at the temple.
Yeah. Yeah.
It had to be presided over by a priest. Well, Jesus, as we learn in Hebrews and other places, is the high priest in the order of Melchizedek. Mm-hmm. This is a priesthood predating even the Levitical priesthood.
Yes.
Now, we know that there had to be an appropriate victim for Passover or for any sacrifice. In Exodus 12, we read of a spotless lamb. Well, we know that Jesus is the only sinless human being. He's the only appropriate sacrifice in terms of a human being. So the first three items, we can check the box. But what about a liturgy? And that's where the Thursday night Passover supper, the Lord's Supper, comes into play. Thursday night, we celebrate this meal that transforms an execution into a sacrifice and helps all of humanity, because Jesus takes upon himself the sin of the world, defeats Satan, defeats death, defeats and reverses the curse of Adam. And it all occurs there, converging at the cross.
Going back to this marvelous diary by this remarkable woman in the late 4th century, on Thursday in Jerusalem, it's a full-blown nearly 24 hours of remembrance and dedication and worship. All that they have been doing the previous week continues that morning. But before they're dismissed, she says that the archdeacon raises his voice and says, "Let us all assemble at 7 o'clock in the church on the Mount of Olives, for there is great effort ahead of us tonight." They are dismissed to have there in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre before they all leave some communion. And then they arrive that night at 7 up on the top of the Mount of Olives. There is a long candlelit procession, I alluded to it a moment ago, down the hill as you and I did several years ago. It's very steep. And then long about the time that the cock crow happens in the early morning, They come down to the Garden of Gethsemane. They do more prayer and hymn singing there. You can imagine that there are a lot of emotions going through the crowd. She writes this, though, that just absolutely floors me. She says, all of the people hear the gospel passage where the Lord was taken away in the Garden of Gethsemane. And she says, and when this passage has been read, there's so great a moaning and groaning of all the people together with the weeping that their lamentation may be heard as far as the city. It reminds me, Carl, of when we were in Jerusalem and there were people from every tribe and tongue and nation there in Jerusalem and celebrating and praying and weeping, yes, also. What a remarkable scene that must have been back then and, well, even to today.
As we were in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, standing just outside the edicule, which encapsulates the tomb of Jesus, there was a large crowd of folks waiting to get in to just have a glimpse. And the people were singing. I don't know what language, I don't know where they were from, but their fervency was evident as they sang, their hearts filled with joy as they were going to see evidence of the resurrection. They were in the very place where Jesus had laid down his life for them, and it was evident that this meant the world to them.
We should mention that the 3 days counting from the night of Maundy Thursday to resurrection morning is called the Great Triduum in the history of the church. Maundy Thursday, Good Friday, then of course Holy Saturday, where there is often a vigil service. And as you know, Carl, in the early church, those who were being brought along in the faith and were to be baptized at Easter Sunday would have been praying and spending the last few moments of preparation before being brought into the body of Christ by baptism. They would have been waiting. That service on Saturday night would have lasted most of the night. Talk about a long church service. And then with the first rays of the sun on Easter Sunday morning, they would have been baptized. Baptism is, throughout the Christian church, very strongly linked to Easter Sunday morning, and that's our tradition at Epiclesis. We baptize on Easter Day. Regardless of your tradition, though, Carl, I guess we should say in our just remaining few moments that getting back into touch with, getting rehooked to our Easter and particularly Holy Week traditions has a wonderful way of reigniting faith, yes?
Indeed it does. And Easter Sunday is like no other. It redefines human history and it reestablishes God's purpose, for there is a new creation that is brought to bear. And our prayer is that everyone will embrace what Jesus has done for them by his death and by his resurrection. And because he lives, we too can live. And that's not just life in the here and now. That's eternal life. For that, we should be eternally grateful.
Indeed. So, folks, from both Dr. Carl Peters and me, I want to say embrace your Christian heritage and the traditions of Holy Week. And let's just wring out all of the worth that we possibly could, especially this year, for our Christian faith in Holy Week. Carl, as always, bless you for taking the time to talk about Holy Week, and I hope and pray that you and your family and all the folks at Anchor Baptist Church will have a very blessed Holy Week and a marvelous season of Easter.
May the Lord bless and keep you and the Epiclesis family. I claim them as my own as well, and it's always a joy and a privilege to be with you, Chris.
Thank you, Carl. Folks, until next time, I want you to remember this. Surely, the road to our Christian future does in fact run through our ancient Christian past. The Lord be with you.
Thank you for joining us for another look at ancient future faith. There is a refreshing wind of renewal blowing through the evangelical church as more and more worshipers turn for inspiration to the rich language and pattern of the ancient church. And they're rediscovering classic Christianity and learning to draw strength from a deep well of time-tested truth and tradition. Want to experience ancient future faith for yourself? Join us for worship at Epiclesis in Sacramento on Sunday mornings at 10:30 a.m. in the chapel at 4600 Winding Way. You can contact us by calling 916-572-9113 or online at epiclesis.org. That's 916-572-9113 or on the web at epiclesis.org.
Hi there, folks. This is Pastor Chris with one more important word before you leave us. things seem to be opening up a little bit these days with regard to the COVID situation, and at Epiclesis we are returning to in-person worship, though in some ways in a limited basis. So if you'd like to join us in person, we need to know ahead of time, please. Just give us an email at info@epiclesis.org. As always, we will continue to simulcast our worship service on the Zoom platform and our Epiclesis Facebook page. For all the latest information, please visit epiclesis.org. The Lord be with you.